Hello and welcome to COVIDcast, a Lowy Institute podcast for anyone interested in understanding the effect of coronavirus on global politics and international life. My name is Alexander Dyant, and I am a research fellow at the Lowy Institute in Sydney, Australia. As this crisis unfolds, we are sitting down with experts from a range of fields to discuss the implication of coronavirus for the world. In this episode, I'll be speaking with one of the most interesting figures on the world stage, Professor Joseph Stiglitz. Professor Stiglitz is a Columbia University professor in economics. He was the former economic advisor to the Clinton administration and chief economist at the World Bank. As a prolific academic and influential advocate in the policy world, Professor Stiglitz has shaped global debates on inequality and economic fairness over the last three decades and continues to do so, especially during those trying times. So I am very grateful that he's taking the time to have a chat directly from his house in Long Island. Professor Stiglitz, thank you for joining me today.
Nice to be here.
First, obviously, I wanted to ask you about the COVID crisis and how this crisis is a disequalizing one. The world is facing the first truly global event since the Second World War, one that all of us are living in together. But the reality is that we are not all being impacted equally by the crisis. The COVID-19 pandemic is a disequalizing crisis that raises inequality both within countries and between countries. Can you explain why and to find out some ways to address this issue?
Well, the reasons why this is being so creating such inequality within countries is this virus is not an equal opportunity virus. It goes after people who are in poor health conditions. And in countries like the United States, where there's not a recognition of access to health as a basic human right, in poor countries where they don't have resources, there are many people with poor health. And that provides a fertile ground for the virus. Relatedly, in many countries like the United States, there are not good systems of social protection. And that combined with high levels of inequality is really terrible because the workers who are most exposed are low-income workers. They're in the poorest health conditions. And without social protection, without paid sick leave, they're living paycheck to paycheck. And if they possibly go to work, they do. And that causes the spread of the disease and makes things worse. Now, the inequalities across countries reflect these differences in the quality of healthcare, the quality of social protection, and the quality of government more generally. So for instance, the United States, again, even though it was a very wealthy country, has among the lowest level of life expectancy that today is lower than it was when President Trump became the president. That means that countries like the United States are affected more adversely than countries that have good healthcare systems like New Zealand or Australia. So these disparities across countries are playing out in a very vicious way. Equally or even more important is the quality of leadership and the ability of governments to respond to the crisis. The United States used to have one of the leading institutes, the Centers for Contagious Disease, CDC, to deal with contagious disease. But under 40 years of denigration of the role of the government have meant that the United States was ill-prepared to respond to the crisis. President Trump defunded the Centers for Disease Control, depleted our stockpiles, disbanded our White House Office of Pandemics. And so that meant we were ill-prepared. But even more importantly was the fact that some societies, there's a respect for science, a trust in government, respect of individuals for each other, a kind of social solidarity. So countries like New Zealand, South Korea, and Germany, and Australia, where people respected each other, wore masks, kept social distancing, they kept the disease down. The countries with authoritarian figures, fascist-like figures, governments that exploited divisions within their countries, like Trump in the United States, Modi in India, Bolsonaro in Brazil, these are the countries that have performed the worst. And so this helps account for the disparities across the country in the response to the pandemic. And then there are corresponding disparities in the economic management in the crisis. And they're very highly correlated. Countries like Denmark and New Zealand that responded well to the pandemic have also responded to the economic aftermath. Countries like the United States that did not respond well to the pandemic have responded disastrously to the aftermath, even though in the United States we spend $3 trillion and the Federal Reserve expanded a balance sheet by $3 trillion. It was a very poorly designed program because there's no presidential leadership.
Do you think that Donald Trump having COVID will change his belief in the health science behind it?
No. He's a genius at self-deception. And I am not hopeful that this will lead to a marked change in course.
Oh, that's unfortunate. Well, one way to solve this crisis is really international cooperation. With the COVID-19 health crisis, there was also like an unleash of a madman pandemic of fear and mistrust around the world. And so today, it seems that the prospect of international cooperation is far away. At the same time, the pandemic is shaking bedrock assumptions about U.S. exceptionalism. This is perhaps the first global crisis in more than a century when no one is even looking for Washington to lead this cooperation exercise. In that context, what are the realistic ways to move back to a world with global cooperation?
Well, first, let me say that there is, in some dimensions, a huge amount of global cooperation. Among the scientific community, there has never been more cooperation. They are working day and night, selflessly, to find out how best to respond to COVID-19. So the problem is leadership in America, leadership in some of the corporations. There's been vaccine nativism. There is profiteering. There is lots of behavior that is, shall I put it mildly, not exemplary. But there's also some very good behavior, not only from the scientists, but you have countries like Costa Rica bringing initiative to the World Health Organization for the sharing of all knowledge related to COVID-19, that realizing this is going to require cooperation in which all the knowledge has to be shared for the betterment of all humanity. So we've seen in many countries around the world really quite striking good behavior. It's brought out the best, it's brought out the worst. Unfortunately, I live in a country where we've seen both, and at the top, we've seen the worst, but we've also seen, as I say, in the scientific community, the really the best. So your answer to what can be done, I think, is very much the idea that there would be a single country in today's 21st century world that would have the kind of critical role that the United States played in the years after World War II, that's a bygone world. We have to have multipolarism, a world where many people take leadership. I think we're going to need to see different countries take leadership in different areas. And hopefully, quite honestly, after the aberration of Trump, America will resume into a kind of leadership role that it did in the past. But I think there's going to be recognition that the world is different. Borders do matter, that there is going to have to be more leadership, you might say, from other countries, less reliance on any single country. And we're going to have to work hard to reconstruct a system of global cooperation. The pandemic has made it very clear that we need to cooperate very, very strongly in fighting a disease. The economic aftermath of a crisis has made it again clear that we have to cooperate. We won't have a global recovery until we have a recovery in all the countries, including the emerging markets and the developing countries. So we're going to need global cooperation. And the most important existential issue for the world today still is climate change. And that is another problem that can only be solved globally with global cooperation.
That's interesting because it looks like for the discussion that I have here at the Institute, a lot of people are saying that, you know, the international system can actually recover after 4 years of Trump, but after eight years of Trump, it will be actually much more difficult.
I think damage has been done.
Yeah.
The longer he's there, the more damage will be done. I've been a little disappointed. The rest of the world at first gave in too often. For instance, at the WTO, important rules-based system for running global trade, he complained that the system was unfair to the United States. He didn't understand. The United States wrote the rules. We were at the forefront of writing the rules. They were unfair to American workers and workers in developing countries. They were unfair to developing countries more broadly, but they were not unfair. They were designed to be a benefit to the United States and other advanced countries. But with the United States walking away, refusing to appoint new judges to the appellate body, the rest of the world should have said, okay, we're not going to let one rogue president in one country destroy what we have worked to create for 70 years, a rules-based international system. And if you don't want to participate, it's your problem. We're going to go ahead. There's been less willingness to confront the United States. We all saw in the debate between Biden and Trump last Tuesday, we saw what a bully he was. But the way to respond to a bully is to stand up and to say, we're not going to fight in a pugilistic way like you are. We're going to go ahead and do the right thing. And the right thing is to create a rules-based international system that is more sensitive to the environment, more sensitive to workers. We're going to improve it. It's not perfect. That's clear. But we're not going to let one person undermine what the rest of the world has worked so hard to create over three quarters of a century.
Actually, I'd like to follow up on this. And I want to ask you about populism. There has been a sharp rise in populism throughout Western democracies. And while populism offers the promise of democratic renewal, but it is also accused of undermining democracy through the weakening of the state bureaucracy. And as we see it in the US, it can go against this global cooperation effort that we were talking about. How do you think our political systems can overcome this risk?
Well, the word populism is used in many different ways, and I'm reluctant to even use the word because it has so many different meanings. There is one meaning that a government that responds to the people, and that's what democracies are supposed to be about. But the way it's come to be used is demagogues trying to take advantage of ordinary citizens by promising things that go beyond the budget constraints, promising them things that are not going to be achievable. And we've seen that in Trump as the demagogue. He's promised a lot, delivered very little. A very deep lack of understanding of international trade. He wants that aspect of populism is linked with nativism, isolationism, blaming everybody else for your own problems. But we failed, and we failed partly because of the role of neoliberalism, the role of the idea that markets could take care of it on their own. But it was our fault. And Trump and the Republicans have been trying to blame others. So that is a very dangerous set of ideas. I think the only way to overcome this risk is to point out that the populists, the demagogues, almost never succeed in delivering on what they promised and almost always get us deeper into problems. And you see now the difficulties our farm sector is having because of the trade wars that Trump has unleashed. the farm sector is on life support from the government. These are proud people, but a very large fraction of their income today comes from the government, not from markets. They talk about market, you know, free market economics. We don't have that anymore. We put them on welfare, effectively, 30%, 50% on. They don't call it welfare. They call it farm subsidies, but it's corporate welfare. And it goes to the richest and farms in the country. So I think we just have to recognize that that kind of populism inevitably leads to failure. He hasn't managed, this demagogue has not managed our economy well. Our unemployment rate spiked at levels we have not seen, at a pace we have not seen. And our GDP fell. Most do not think we will be back to where we were until 2022 at the earliest, and probably after that, depending, of course, on what happens in November.
Now I'd like to talk about the debt crisis in developing countries. Many low and middle income countries will still have to pay a combined $130 billion in debt service this year, around half of which is owed to private creditors. With much economic activity suspended and fiscal revenues in free fall, many countries will be forced to default. At this stage, we face the risk of global debt crisis. Could you please describe the nature of the current debt problem in developing countries and identify some of the factors that led them in such a precarious position?
Well, you know, there was a major debt relief program called HIPIC, the Jubilee movement at the turn of the millennium. But after that, many banks saw an opportunity to lend. It's very difficult when politicians are confronted with an opportunity to get funds at low interest rates. Remember, in the post-2008 world, interest rates were very, very low, and there was a search for yield. And the result was that lenders didn't do prudent lending. They pushed money onto developing countries and emerging markets. They said it was important to get a rating. Why it was important was never clear. And basically, they pushed money on developing countries beyond their capacity to repay. I wrote about this a half decade ago. I said, we're going to have another debt crisis coming. We might have been able to avoid it if nothing bad happened. But the nature of life is bad things do happen. Not necessarily as bad as the pandemic, but we know that there are ups and downs to the economy. And so I viewed it as always reckless. And now, in the aftermath of the pandemic, your numbers were spot on. There is a very high risk. Every aspect of the sources of income for developing countries and emerging markets has been hit. Remittances, exports, commodity prices, you name it, they're facing it. The crisis is a very deep one. The G20 said that there should be a stay for the least developed countries on official debt. It's good that they're asking for this, but it's not enough. As you mentioned, a lot of the debt is private, not the official debt, which is debt from the government. And the private sector is refusing to go along. They're selfish. They're short-sighted. So we need mechanisms to induce the private sector to cooperate. But the problem is more than a stay. A stay is just not paying today. But as you described it, the economic downturn is severe. And many of these countries are going to need debt restructuring. In 2015, the UN General Assembly passed a resolution setting forth a set of principles for a sovereign debt restructuring process. And in 2014, they had already adopted the notion that there should be some sovereign debt restructuring mechanism. I had chaired a global commission that had been appointed by the president of the UN in the aftermath of the 2008-09 crisis, and we had strongly recommended that this kind of system be set up. It was overwhelmingly supported by the members of the UN, but a few countries opposed. But unfortunately, they were the powerful countries like the United States. And so as we enter this pandemic, we do not have a good mechanism for sovereign debt restructuring. Historical experience shows that debt restructurings come too late and are too little. Now, there's another thing that needs to be done. The international community has to come together to help the developing countries. And there's a mechanism for doing that. The head of the IMF has called for an issuance of $500 billion in what are called special drawing rights, SDRs. Unfortunately, two countries opposed, the United States and India. Neither of them is a clear why. No good reason was ever put forward. And many countries, many of the developed countries, have actually been very generous and said they will donate or lend their SDRs to countries that really need it. So while many countries were showing acts of generosity, cooperation, India and the United States were showing a kind of selfishness that was hard to fathom and consistent with the kind of behavior that we've seen from demagogues in a consistent way in response to the pandemic. I'm hopeful when November comes, there will be an issuance of SDRs. In fact, the Democrats in the U.S. Congress in both the Senate and the House have introduced legislation for $2 trillion of SDR issuance. And I hope that countries like Australia and other countries around the world will join in this effort to make sure that these funds are used for those countries that really, really need it.
For my last question, I'd like to come closer to home now. So today in Australia, the federal government will hand down its long-expected budget. So far, the Australian economic response to COVID-19 has been in many ways exemplary. The fear now is that the Conservative government, which so far has spent big on income protection schemes from the left playbook, will revert to its ideological roots. Australia may run the risk of stimulus stopping before the recovery can take hold. First, how would you rank Australia's response to the crisis? And second, what would be your advice to our government on what to do next to keep up the success?
The numbers suggest very strongly that Australia has done very well. And as you say, it's borrowed from the left's playbook in the economics, and it followed the model that the good governments have played around the world. So that's a good thing. But in Australia, as in the United States, the right is now uncertain about which way to go. They're pulling the plug just when we need the money so badly. So to talk about it in a minute, in the United States, we put $3 trillion in the first set of packages. Now the downturn is continuing. It's not a V-shaped recovery. There are millions and millions of Americans who are unemployed, and the Republicans are refusing to give the money that is necessary to keep them from suffering. They're refusing to give money to the states and localities, which are at the forefront in providing health, education, welfare, whose revenues are plummeting. And the report that just came out last Friday on unemployment shows the largest increase in unemployment is among public government, state and local government workers. Educational institutions are being devastated because the costs are going up for running educational institutions and the revenues are going down. And these knowledge institutions are the future of any country, and they're being devastated. So ideology on the right is overcoming common sense. And effectively, if it continues, it will mean the $3 trillion, I won't say has gone down the drain, but will only have forestalled the disastrous outcomes that are around the corner. Now, I think I send the same message to Australia. Once an economy goes down, damage can be very deep. In other words, preventing damage makes so much more sense and is so much cheaper than trying to repair once the damage has occurred. And so it is really foolish not to spend the money. These are investments. Now, you have to make sure the money does dual purpose, triple purpose. By that, I mean, you're spending a lot of money and you want to make sure that money leads to a better post-pandemic economy. You want to make address the climate crisis, address their inequalities, make a more resilient economy, a more knowledge-based economy. Yes, you'll have more debt, but think about the asset side. The asset side, the strengths of the economy will be more than compensating for the liability side. No company looks just at the debt, you look at the assets. This is a time to make those valuable investments that will make the Australian economy emerge from the pandemic far stronger than it was going into the pandemic.
Look, this is all we have time for today. Thank you very much, Professor Stiglitz, for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thank you.
COVIDcast is a limited edition podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thank you to my colleagues, Roland Raja, for helping me prepare for this interview, and Jennifer Reinhardt for production assistance. Please keep an eye on our social media channels for details of the next episode of COVIDcast. And you can stay up to date with all the previous episodes on the homepage of our website. Thank you all for listening today, and stay tuned for our next episode.